Thomas Jefferson had never been sure in the first place that the Constitution was a good idea. Not, mind you, that anyone had consulted him about it, since he had been in Paris as American minister to France during the Constitutional Convention, and only returned to the United States to find the political mechanics of the Constitution already in full operation. But the Constitution did not strike him, even from afar, as much of an improvement on the Articles of Confederation. I confess there are things in it which stagger all my dispositions to subscribe to what such an assembly has proposed, he wrote in 1787, beginning with the presidency, which seems a bad addition of a Polish king. Taken together, I think all the good of this new constitution might have been couched in three or four new articles to be added to the good, old, and venerable fabric, which should have been preserved even as a religious relic, which may be the only time anyone ever spoke with what could be called affection about the Articles of Confederation. 12 years of Federalist rule, and especially 12 years of dealing with Alexander Hamilton, and then with his one-time friend John Adams, had only made the defects of the Constitution glare more harshly for Jefferson. The American Revolution, he said, had begun with the purpose of introducing a just and solid republican government that would become a standing monument and example for the aim and imitation of the people of other countries. But it had been betrayed by the machinations of the Federalists into copying much too closely the trappings of a centralized British monarchy. At length, however, Americans had come to realize their peril, and they had elected Thomas Jefferson to correct the course of the Republic, to put her on her Republican tack, and show by the beauty of her motion the skill of her builders. On the 4th of March, 1801, he proposed to give visible proof of that new course by setting aside anything in his inaugural ceremonies that looked like a coronation. John Adams had ridden to his inauguration in a coach and six. Jefferson walked from his boarding house on the south side of Capitol Hill to the Senate chamber in the Capitol, shook hands with his vice president, Aaron Burr, and took the oath of office. That was it. He did not move into the executive mansion until March 19th. Surprisingly, Jefferson's inaugural address, which he merely submitted in writing rather than delivering as an oration, was an eloquent appeal for reconciliation with the Federalists after the turmoil of the Whiskey Rebellion, the Jay Treaty, and the quasi-war with France. Let us, he said, unite with one heart and one mind that harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are but dreary things. Every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle. We have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. But suspicious and unrepentant Federalists saw an iron hand inside that velvet glove. That speech, snorted one Federalist newspaper, was but a net to ensnare popularity. Mr. Jefferson comes forward with the smile of French philanthropy in his countenance. We are all Federalists. We are all Republicans. Dropping from his tongue, his right hand weaving with gestures of liberality and affection, and his left concealed under his cloak, grasping a bundle of, "Sir, your services are no longer needed." Nor was this just the customary Federalist paranoia. In 1799, Jefferson wrote to the chronically dissatisfied Elbridge Gerry to outline exactly the plan he meant to follow if elected president. First, he would dismantle the administrative apparatus developed by Hamilton in his series of reports as Secretary of the Treasury. I am for a government rigorously frugal and simple, wrote Jefferson, applying all the possible savings of the public revenue to the discharge of the national debt, and not for a multiplication of officers and salaries merely to make partisans, and increasing by every device the public debt on the principle of its being a public blessing. Second, Jefferson would not only demobilize the additional army that had been raised under Adams, but slice spending on national defense as a whole to the bone, since spending on armies and navies only created tax burdens which erased the independence of virtuous farmers. I am for relying, for internal defense, on our militia solely, till actual invasion, and for such a naval force only as may protect our coasts and harbors from such depredations as we have experienced, and not for a standing army in time of peace which may overawe the public sentiment, nor for a navy which by its own expenses and the eternal wars in which it will implicate us will grind us with public burdens and sink us under them. Third, Jefferson would show no favoritism in foreign policy, which, since John Adams' last important initiative had actually been to end the quasi-war with France, meant that Jefferson would be showing no favoritism to the British in particular. I am not for linking ourselves by new treaties with the quarrels of Europe, entering that field of slaughter to preserve their balance, or, and this made his anti-British sentiments clear, joining in the Confederacy of Kings to war against the principles of liberty. What Jefferson really meant by "we are all Republicans, we are all Federalists" was actually no parties at all. If we can hit on the true line, which may conciliate the honest part of those who were called Federalists, Jefferson wrote to Horatio Gates, I should hope to obliterate the names of Federalist and Republican. In practice, what that meant was eliminate Federalists and everyone become a Jeffersonian. But whether the Federalists went willingly or not, Jefferson was determined by the establishment of Republican principles to sink Federalism into an abyss from which there shall be no resurrection for it. Jefferson's first strategy for creating the Federalist abyss was to evict Federalists from federal officeholding, which he did with gusto. Of the 316 federal offices under Jefferson's direct appointment, and this did not include postmasters, much larger category which was usually left to the oversight of the Postmaster General, Jefferson forced out 146 incumbents, 46%, most, if not all of whom, were Federalists. Tax collectors and inspectors and the whiskey excise they had tried to collect were also eliminated. The sedition law was allowed to expire. Individuals who had been indicted under the other anti-French acts were pardoned. The diplomatic corps was reduced to just three missions, to Britain, France, and Spain. Jefferson then turned his eye on the federal judiciary. In the last weeks of the Adams administration, the Sixth Congress, and let me pause to explain something about the numbering of Congress. Although the Senate and members of the Senate are elected for 6 years and on staggered terms, the House of Representatives is elected every 2 years, so that, in fact, the entire House of Representatives undergoes a turnover of sorts every 2 years or twice during a presidential administration. Very early on, Congress got into the habit of numbering Congresses according to that two-year turnover in the House of Representatives. So in Washington's first administration, for instance, the Congresses were the first and second Congresses, each of which, by the way, was divided into two sessions. Washington's second administration was the occasion for the third and fourth Congresses, Adams's single term as president was host to the fifth and then finally the sixth Congress. That sixth Congress, of course, was the last one to meet under John Adams' presidency. And that sixth Congress took the opportunity to adopt a Judiciary Act at almost the last minute that reorganized the structure of the federal judiciary, reducing the number of Supreme Court justices to five and dividing the federal appeals courts into 19 district court and 6 circuit courts. What made this reorganization something less than a mere reshuffling of the deck was the opportunity the Judiciary Act provided to John Adams, first for the more active enforcement of the Alien and Sedition Acts, but then to appoint a full slate of Federalists to fill 13 of the new judgeships, starting at the very top with John Marshall as the new Chief Justice. Republicans, like Jefferson, sneered at the appointments as midnight judges, since Adams was supposed to have stayed up late on his last evening in office to sign their appointment papers. Jefferson could not constitutionally dismiss federal judges, but with a 65-40 majority in the House of Representatives, and only 2 votes shy of a majority in the Senate, Jeffersonian Republicans would be able to get the Judiciary Act repealed by the 7th Congress and replaced, in April of 1802, with a new Judiciary Act. The jobs of the midnight judges appointed by John Adams thereby simply ceased to exist. One Federalist Supreme Court Justice, Samuel Chase, protested that the circuit judges cannot, directly or indirectly, be deprived of their offices or commissions or salaries during their lives, unless only on impeachment, as prescribed in the Constitution. Whereupon congressional Republicans, led by the acerbic John Randolph of Roanoke, impeached Chase on 8 counts, and only fell 3 votes shy in the Senate of convicting him. Jefferson was even determined to republicanize the style of the presidency. The executive mansion was still only scantily furnished with articles brought from Philadelphia, and Jefferson was disinclined to spend much money changing that, even closing down the East Room entirely. His office was dominated by a long table with drawers on each side, in which were deposited not only articles appropriate to the place, but a set of carpenter's tools in one and small garden implements in another. In the window recesses were stands for the flowers and plants, which it was his delight to attend. And among his roses and geraniums was suspended the cage of his favorite mockingbird, which he cherished with peculiar fondness. Whenever he was alone, he opened the cage and let the bird fly about the room. After flitting for a while from one object to another, it would alight on his table and regale him with its sweetest notes, or perch on his shoulder and take its food from his lips. William Plummer, a New Hampshire Federalist and a Baptist lay preacher who shrank from Jefferson's reputation as a man of science and infidel in religion, nevertheless slowly warmed to the new president's charms. The more impartially I examine the character and conduct of Mr. Jefferson, the more favorably I think of his integrity. I have, I am inclined to think, done him injustice in this respect. The Pennsylvania Republican, William McClay, who had more reason politically to admire Jefferson, found Jefferson oddly impressive. "Jefferson is a slender man," he wrote in his journal in the spring of 1790. "He sits in a lounging manner, on one hip commonly, and with one of his shoulders elevated much above the other. His whole figure has a loose, shackling air. Even his discourse partook of his personal demeanor. It was loose and rambling, and yet He scattered information wherever he went, and some even brilliant sentiments sparkled from him. When Jefferson decided to run for re-election in 1804, his victory was even more smashing than the one of 1800, winning 162 out of 176 electoral votes for himself and his new vice president, the inveterate New York Federalist hater, George Clinton. But Jefferson's loose-jointed charm could not reconcile every Federalist or solve every problem. The man who had prompted Philip Freneau to found a partisan newspaper to attack Alexander Hamilton now found newspaper partisanship turned fully on himself. James Thomas Callender, a Republican journalist who had been imprisoned under the Adams administration and pardoned by Jefferson, demanded a federal job as a reward from Jefferson. Jefferson declined. And Callender, who was by then the editor of the Richmond Recorder, took his revenge by revealing that Jefferson, a widower for almost 20 years, had consoled himself in the embraces of one of his slaves, Sally Hemings. Federalist newspapers took up the revelation with glee. Harry Crosswell, the editor of the New York Wasp, chortled happily, "Mr. Jefferson has for years past, while his wife was living and does now since she is dead, keep a woolly-headed concubine by the name of Sally, that by her he had several children, and that one of them by the name of Tom has, since his father's election, taken upon himself many airs of importance and boasted his extraction from a president." This sent the thin-skinned Jefferson over the moon. "Federalist editors," he raged, "fill their newspapers with falsehoods, calumnies, and audacities." And he hinted broadly to Pennsylvania Governor Thomas McCain that seditious libel of the sort described in Adams's Alien and Sedition Acts be retrieved from that Federalist abyss. "I have therefore long thought that a few prosecutions of the most prominent offenders would have a wholesome effect in restoring the integrity of the presses." "Not a general prosecution," Jefferson added hastily, "for that would look like persecution, but a selected one." And while he could kick Federalist officeholders into the Federalist abyss, he could not kick Hamiltonian fiscal policy there quite so easily. Despite his persistent shyness, Thomas Jefferson spent virtually all of his life from 1774 in one form or other of public service. But apart from the soaring Enlightenment eloquence he poured into the Declaration of Independence, he had accomplished surprisingly little. He had been governor of Virginia during the Revolution and failed to keep the British from chasing him out of his office in Williamsburg. He had been minister to France and Washington's Secretary of State, and mostly without distinction. "He has much fine sense," noted the shrewd William Plummer, "yet little of the plain common sense so necessary for the practical statesman." Jefferson's electoral victories were due more to the popularity of his doctrines than by his strength of personal character or by the practical wisdom of his public measures. Now, as president, the pattern repeated itself. As much as he hated Hamilton's Bank of the United States and the decision to fund the national debt in full, Hamilton had pledged the nation's honor to funding the debt. And to change that now would hurt Americans who owned federal securities and destroy American credit abroad, where, ironically, that credit was presently boosting the sale of American agricultural products. When this government was first established, Jefferson erupted to Pierre Samuel DuPont in January 1802. It was possible to have set it a-going on true principles. But the contracted, English, half-lettered ideas of Hamilton destroyed that hope in the bud. "We can pay off his debt in 15 years, but we can never get rid of his financial system. It mortifies me to be strengthening principles which I deem radically vicious. But this vice is entailed on us by a first error. Nor did matters abroad cooperate with Jefferson's wishes. No sooner had Jefferson canceled the remainder of the Navy's frigate-building program and mothballed the existing ones in favor of building a fleet of 100 coast-defense gunboats than the Barbary pirates cheerfully renewed their demands for bribes. When Jefferson refused, Yusuf Karamanli, the Pasha of Tripoli, declared war, and Jefferson was forced to haul the decommissioned frigates out of retirement and send them to the Mediterranean to teach the pirates a lesson. Except, of course, that the pirates proved recalcitrant learners. They captured the frigate Philadelphia when it ran aground on the Calayusa Reef off Tripoli Harbor in October of 1803 and enslaved its crew. In 1805, Karamanli finally signed an agreement to end the war, but only after Jefferson had pledged $60,000 to ransom American sailors whom Karamanli was holding. And then there was France. In 1799, the last facade of the Revolutionary Republic crumbled as Napoleon Bonaparte overthrew the Directory. And in 1804, he crowned himself as Emperor of France. "I have grieved," Jefferson wrote, "to see even good Republicans so infatuated as to this man as to consider his downfall as calamitous to the cause of liberty. To whine after this exorcised demon is a disgrace to Republicans and must have arisen either from want of reflection or the indulgence of passion against principle." Nevertheless, for all his suspicions of Bonaparte, Jefferson was more than willing to barter with Napoleon. And rather like a Polish king, after all, if opportunity beckoned, which it did in 1803. Having extorted from Spain title to the enormous western land stretching west of the Mississippi River, Napoleon Bonaparte soon lost interest in trying to reestablish a French empire in the New World, and offered to sell to the United States the great entrepot of New Orleans and all of the Louisiana province, approximately 830,000 square miles, for $15 million in spot cash. This Louisiana purchase was approved by Jefferson before consulting with Congress, and justified by him afterward on grounds very close to the invocation of necessary and proper powers which Hamilton had used for the Bank of the United States. But no matter to Jefferson. "The less we say about constitutional difficulties," he observed, "the better." The Senate ratified the agreement in October, and American officials took formal possession of Louisiana in ceremonies at New Orleans on December 20th, 1803. The British were not amused by these dealings with Bonaparte. The British had hoped to seize New Orleans for themselves and thus control the Mississippi River Valley in much the same way that their occupation of Gibraltar controlled access to the Mediterranean. The great British naval victory at Trafalgar in 1805 wrecked Bonaparte's hopes of challenging British preeminence at sea. But that only produced a whipsaw response for American shipping. Bonaparte declared a continental embargo of Britain in 1806 and threatened to seize any American ships in European waters whom he suspected of trading with Britain. The British responded with fresh orders in council that demanded search privileges of American shipping they suspected of trading with France. Ground between these two stones, American shippers lost 1,500 ships to British and French seizure over 9 years. In the spring of 1806 alone, one single British ship of the line, HMS Leander, every morning at daybreak, blithely stopped the progress of all vessels leaving New York Harbor, searching them for both contraband cargoes and for deserters from the Royal Navy. And piling up a dozen and sometimes a couple of dozen ships lying a league or two off the port, losing their fair wind before Leander's boarding parties had finished searching them. Nor did the British stop with merchant vessels. On June 22, 1807, the United States frigate Chesapeake, bound for the Mediterranean to relieve the USS Constitution as flagship of the Navy's Mediterranean squadron, was hailed by the British frigate HMS Leopard off the Virginia Capes. A jolly boat from the British ship pulled alongside the Chesapeake with a request: heave to and permit a search of the Chesapeake's crew for deserters. The Chesapeake's senior officer, Commodore James Barron, feigned incomprehension, trying to buy time to clear his ship for action. The British did not wait. A broadside from the Leopard killed 3 American sailors and wounded 18, including Commodore Barron, who had no choice but to strike his colors and allow the British to come aboard and drag off 4 accused deserters. Jefferson wrote that he had never, since the Battle of Lexington, seen this country in such a state of exasperation as it was over the Chesapeake outrage. But Jefferson, through his own parsimony, had no fleet at hand for retaliating against the Royal Navy. Instead, he proposed a pox on both your houses boycott. The United States would break off all commerce with both Britain and France until they came to their senses and permitted American ships to trade freely once again. Jefferson's Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin, was much more dubious about the possible results, counseling Jefferson that an embargo for a limited time will at this moment be preferable and less objectionable in Congress. But in every other respect, the privations, sufferings, revenue effect on the enemy, politics at home, etc., would be so great that Gallatin actually would prefer war to a permanent embargo. Nevertheless, when the 10th Congress assembled in December 1807, 6 months after the Chesapeake affair, Jefferson recommended in his annual message a unilateral embargo, an inhibition of the departure of our vessels from the ports of the United States. And after 4 days of deliberation, Congress obligingly passed an embargo act on any ship or vessel bound to any foreign port or place. They quickly had reason to regret it. Jefferson liked to believe that an economy based on the virtuous independent farmer had no need of imports or exports. Every family in the country is a manufactory within itself, Jefferson wrote, and is very generally able to make within itself all the stouter and middling stuffs for its own clothing and household use. This was an illusion. The American economy depended much more heavily than he liked to admit on the exports and the overseas carrying trade. Britain lost, it is true, 58% of the value of its exports to the United States, which fell from 12 million pounds per annum to just 5.3 million. But American exporters suffered a catastrophic wipeout of 73%. Exports shrank from 6.5 million to just 1.7 million pounds. Smuggling along the Canadian border was so unrestrained that Gallatin advised Jefferson that only the most arbitrary measures could suppress it. Ironically, the domestic manufacturing that Jefferson despised actually blossomed behind what was, in effect, an unlimited tariff wall. There were 15 cotton mills in the United States in 1808. By 1809, 87 had been built. But otherwise, the impact was horrendous on the American economy. A budding 13-year-old poet named William Cullen Bryant satirized the embargo with adult skill. curse of our nation, source of countless woes, from whose dark womb unreckoned misery flows. The embargo rages. Paint the mournful scene, the saddening street, the desolated green, how hungry laborers leave their toil and sigh, and sorrow droops in each desponding eye. See the bold sailor from the ocean torn, his element sink friendless and forlorn, his suffering spouse the tear of anguish shed, his starving children cry in vain for bread. Despite the protests, Jefferson refused to admit that the embargo had been a mistake, even though by the end of his second term in 1808, he had quietly given up trying to enforce it. By the end of that term, Jefferson had grown weary of fighting Hamilton's incubus. "I am tired of an office where I can do no more good than many others who would be glad to be employed in it," he sighed. "To myself personally, it brings nothing but unceasing drudgery and daily loss of friends. My only consolation is in the belief that my fellow citizens at large give me credit for good intentions. As for Hamilton's schemes, they had succeeded all too well." Well might Jefferson have complained, in the words of Lin-Manuel Miranda's hip-hop-infused musical, Hamilton, "How does a bastard orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman, dropped in the middle of a forgotten spot in the Caribbean by Providence impoverished to squalor, grow up to be a hero and a scholar?" "Very well," Jefferson wearily conceded. "Let us have banks, so long as they are ones to be found in any country on earth except Great Britain. As it was, the British have indeed the consolation of Satan on removing our first parents from paradise. From a peaceable and agricultural nation, he makes us a military and manufacturing one, and not a Jeffersonian one after all."